Welcome and good morning. My name is Rob and I am a compulsive overeater and one of your co-hosts for this session. Let's begin with the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity,
to
accept the things I can change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. For those planning to attend the closing session after the keynote this morning, the convention committee would like you to have a piece of paper and markers and crayons or a pen handy. You have time to go grab them now. Like right now, go get them. Before we kick off the session, in honor of our 11th tradition, we respectfully ask that no OA member be photographed, videotaped, or identified by full name at the level of press, radio, film, television, and other public media of communication, which includes the internet or any other new media technologies. Please protect your anonymity and only use your first name and last initial as your screen name. You can use the rename function to do so. We will also be renaming people if we see that their full last name is on the screen. The opinions expressed in this session are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. OA members are reminded that when sharing to speak to your recovery and the solutions offered by the 12 steps of Overeaters Anonymous. Note that the attendee to attendee chat feature is now disabled. During this session, to minimize disruption and crosstalk, you will be able to chat with the co-host only. If you are having a technical problem, please mute yourself when you are not sharing and turn off your video when you're moving around or if you're eating. Finally, for your information, all sessions are being recorded, audio only in their entirety. If you notice up on the top of your screen there's a record button that might be going. When Rona is done her speaking, we're gonna turn that off and it'll go away and the sharing will not be recorded. When we place these recordings on our website, we will edit them only to have the panelists share and no open sharing or questions will be included. I will now turn the meeting over to Mary Frances, a true Pittsburgh Steelers fan, and introduce our keynote speaker.
Well, thank you for that, Rob. Good morning, everybody. My name is Mary Frances. I'm a grateful compulsive overeater. And it's my pleasure this morning to introduce to you Rona. I first met Rona when I was a region rep from South Central Pennsylvania, and she was a region rep from Philadelphia area intergroup back in the mid to late 80s. And we served at region together for a number of years and even served on the board and also had the opportunity to go to World Service Business Conference together. I had since moved to the Philadelphia area, and even though we had lost touch over time, back in 2010, Rona reached out to me on Facebook and threw me a life preserver because I had been in a pretty darn long relapse. And I just want to say that I'm very blessed to have Rona in my life. She is a wonderful, sweet spirit. And I'm just really grateful that she's here today to share her story with us.
Well, thank you, Mary Frances. And boy, it has been a long time. It's a long road, right? So a lot of life in all those years. We were babies back then, and now we're old ladies. Well, I'm Rona, and by the grace of God, I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be sharing at this convention. And I hope you've been having a great time. I was thinking about the topic this morning, anchors away. And I love the word anchor. I think anchor is a great word. I don't want to look at myself. How did I get on the screen here? Can we get that back to gallery view? Here, wait a second. I got to look at you, not me. All right, that's much better. All right. You're all much better to look at than me. So I think of anchors as being really important, especially if you think about life. I think about recovery, and I'm going to talk about a lot of really important things, and I'll tell you my story. I'll tell you about my recovery. I think it's really important to talk about the solution because I think we all need answers. I don't think you need to hear all about the problems. I think we need to hear about the answers, and anchors are answers. And the solutions in the program are the way out. And that's what we need, is how to recover, how to stay recovered, and how to live a sane and healthy life. And I think it's so that's where I'm going to put my story. I'm going to tell you where I came from so you understand I belong in this program. And I think sometimes we can put people who are in recovery up on pedestals. And I just want to say, all I've done is follow the same program that was laid out for us by the AA people a long time ago. And I really am very, very thankful for the people in the program who said, read the big book. That's where the program is. That's where the answers are. Read the 12 steps, study them, work them. That's where the answers are. And I am very thankful I have long-term recovery because I just did what they said. I follow, I listen, and it works, and it's true. But I don't feel like what I have is anything special. I feel like we don't need to look for something different. I think we have the answers, and we just have to actually do what we were instructed to do and just follow and listen. So I really want to encourage you, as I tell my story, to listen, not to think of me as anything special, because all I am is one more person who followed the instructions. And we have a manual full of really great answers. And every one of us can have the recovery program. But anyway, anchors, I just want to talk about that briefly because anchors, this topic, anchors, is so important. Here we are in the middle of a pandemic. And I think I often talk to people and I think about for myself, the things that I do in my recovery, I do every day, knowing that any day the storms of life will be coming, because they do. They always come. It's, you can't like think that, oh, I'm going to do my recovery when things get better, because there's always going to be something that's going to come. So if I always say, like, I have to kind of close the doors and seal them shut. And that means keeping my recovery strong in a way, making sure I have my anchors. My food plan needs to be clear. Recovery practices need to be clear. These are my anchors. My anchors are the solid things that I keep in place so that when the storms of life come, those things I can hold on to, and they will keep me when there's a pandemic or somebody breaks my heart or somebody dies or somebody leaves or, you know, I have a financial burden that I can't handle and I feel, or whatever it is, or even when I'm happy, or, and you know, all the reasons and excuses for eating, then the anchors are what get us through. I love sitting in my home meeting and hearing people saying during this pandemic, at least I have my abstinence. At least I have my recovery. At least I have you. You know, and that's the anchors. That's how this works. We have, hold on to our anchors. And so that's what we're going to, as we talk, just listen to the anchors, because I'm going to tell you my story and my recovery, but it's all anchors. Everything I do and practice in my recovery is the anchors. So I was thinking about it this morning. It was around this time, right in 1980, that I was about ready to start to hit my bottom that led me to OA. Let my puppy out. So I came in 1981, January 1981. I was a senior in high school. So I was about queuing up at that point to hit my bottom right around this time, 40 years ago. And so I would say that for a 17-year-old, I was in pretty bad shape. I was eating, binging. How we say it's a progressive problem. For me, I was binging so out of control. I was one of these people who would starve all day and then binge all night. And so I had the fantasy every day that I was going to kick it today. So my crazy fantasy was I was going to starve myself skinny, of course, and that didn't work. So I would like starve all day and then I would binge all night. Before I binged, I would go to the gym and swim 2 miles and run 5 miles and sit in the sauna. And then I would go to a fast food place and get junk food and then go home and eat like a half gallon of ice cream and a box of cookies and a jar of peanut butter. And I was taking amphetamines and I was, I was just a wreck. And it was like a high speed wreck into, I wanted to die. It was like a fast and furious rolling down a hill, down into a very low bottom at a very young age. And so I think all of us, our food addictions come out in different ways. Some of us, it's more of a slow progression. For me, it was a fast progression. And I got really sick really fast. Although I do believe, and I make jokes that I think if anybody was wired for food addiction, I definitely think I came out of the womb looking for sugar. Like if that's a possibility, that would be me. I was having tantrums when I was a kid that if my parents ever tried to make me eat anything that wasn't white flour and sugar, I wouldn't eat it. And so I think it was absolutely, I was hooked on sugar and white flour. And somehow or another, I got away with just eating Pop-Tarts and Captain Crunch for breakfast and peanut butter and jelly and white flour, bread for lunch and spaghetti for dinner. And so, I mean, basically my entire diet was white flour and sugar. So I was like, you know, really a sick person. And so, you know, I'm very thankful that I didn't kill myself before I got to OA, but, basically I was about taking the first step before I got in, because my mom, who was obsessed with weight and still is, by the way, at 80 something, she's still in it. She's still in the obsession and going to the gyms and doing the Weight Watchers and telling us about the Weight Watchers meals and all this stuff. But she, of course, couldn't tolerate my growing body and the fact that I was getting overweight. So her looks at me and what I was looking like was actually a part of me going downhill as well. It was a really crazy life, you know. On the one hand, we're on these diet kicks. On the other hand, you know, there was body shaming. So, you know, and there was also a lot of junk food. So, you know, the house was full of all this junk food, and then I was being shamed for eating it. So it was, you know, and for being fat. So it was, you know, total insanity. But right before I came to OA, my mom was taking me to a diet program, one of those starvation diets, you know, another one. And they were about to put down a whole bunch of money because, of course, I was a teenager and I was getting very overweight. And I think my mother would rather die than have a fat teenager. But so they were going to, you know, they were, you know, offering to get me a car if I would lose weight. They would, you know, but I couldn't. I mean, I couldn't stop. My addiction was stronger than me. And so it didn't matter. I couldn't stop for a car. I couldn't stop for anything. That's why I thought I should just move to a country where it was okay to be fat. Or, I mean, of course, this is the mind of a teenager, but, you know, or die. Those were the two choices. And so my mom took me to this diet program and they were about to pay money. And I knew in my heart that I couldn't take my parents' money because I knew I couldn't follow a diet at 17. I knew that there was no, I knew that the ability to follow a diet already was done. That I already had tried so many diets and all of the routines of that I couldn't follow it. And so I couldn't take my parents' money. And I just told them, forget it. And then that's when I got really depressed. And so I went to a psychologist who gave me the diagnosis of major depressive disorder, I guess, because I wanted to die. But of course, at that point, they didn't know about food addiction and they didn't even know about bulimia. And there was no eating disorders diagnosis or treatment centers or anything. So I just was being given the diagnosis of major depression. But no one looked at, you know, how food affects your mood, or how, you know, being obsessed with food, or, you know, I couldn't even concentrate. I couldn't concentrate in school. I could barely do my homework. I could barely do anything right. I felt like such a mess. I'd be with friends, and while I was with them, I would be with them, but I was thinking about food and my weight all the time. It was, I think the insanity, the mental insanity and the obsession in some ways was even worse than what was going on with my behavior with food and everything. So, you know, it just was driving me crazy. So I got to OA somehow by a miracle, I'm sure, because I really was hopeless when I came in. Like step one, you know, I was as hopeless as they get. I did not feel that anything would work for me. So the fact that I met this man who went to camp with this man who was a nurse, and he had lost a whole bunch of weight, but he was like totally different. You know how we get when we change. He was like peaceful and different. And he told me he went to OA in Philadelphia at this meeting. And I somehow or another, I ended up in the meeting. I don't know how, I mean, it's a miracle, really. I believe that it was a miracle that I went, because I had lost hope. And back then, you know, I think in the Philadelphia area, those of you who are from Philadelphia, the meetings tend to be very strong in that area, much more so than in other parts of, I think, in other areas. But Philadelphia is very, very fortunate to have the kind of OA that it does. And I was very, very blessed to be in these meetings, because the meetings were full of very strong recovery, people with years and years of abstinence, and just, you know, people were lit up on recovery. It was super charged. You could go into the meeting and people were like really good. They were solid. It was like a very positive place. So I got help. You know, I here I was this teenager, and there were all these people like my mother's age. I hated my mother. And there was like these moms in the room, but everybody was so nice to me. I sat in the back. I was all dark, wearing black, big, long, you know how you hide under the big clothes. I was wearing, I felt horrible. I was like so dark and depressed. And there I was sitting in the back of the room. And, you know, somehow or another, people came up, and you know how the love of the program, right? And then people like come up and they loved up on me, you know? And there was a young woman, like 20 something, who kind of just took me under her wings, and she probably saved my life because she took my phone number. I never would have gone back, but she kept coming after me. So I kept coming back, and the recovery program worked. But it took me 2.5 years to get abstinent. And it took me about 5 more years after that before I stopped being obsessed with food. And I've been free. And I'm telling you the truth. I know I used to sit in the back of the room and listen to people who said things like this. And I thought, this can't be true. This can't be true that you can be free like that. And I thought people were full of crap. These people who were happy and free and all this stuff that they would talk about from, you know, like the promises of the program. I thought it's not real. But I'm here to tell you, actually, I've been abstinent since May of 1983 for real. And I don't fight with food. I don't fight with food. It's not an option for me to... My anchors are in. I eat what I'm supposed to eat, and I don't eat my drug foods, and I don't use food as a drug. That's not an option. I don't do bites, licks, and tastes. I don't go off my plan and just start picking at things that don't belong in my mouth. I only eat the way I'm supposed to eat for my healthy nourishing, and I eat foods that I like. I don't eat on a restrictive diety way. I eat foods that I like, that are good and tasty and nourishing and healthy at my meal times, that are planned, not for entertainment or abuse. All food abuse is off the table. That's my step one. I know that if I pick up one thing that's out of the lines, I will reactivate that that addictive process. So for me, step one is staying in the lines. And it took me a long time to surrender, to understand and roll over and just face the fact that I have to live like that. A lot of testing, a lot of trying to see how far I can get away with this or get away with that, pushing the limits, seeing if I can, you know, have this food or do this thing. And then I, you know, coming to realize, you know, for me, surrender is, you know, I would no longer walk into a boxing ring with a prize winning boxer and think I could win, then walk into a ring with one of my addictive foods or behaviors. That's insanity for me to think I can handle something I have already learned that every time I try to handle that, I end up in my addiction. So I know what behaviors and what foods activate my addiction. And I need to stay away from them under all circumstances, no matter what's going on. It's 100% not an option to cross the lines. And so that means I have to prepare, I have to plan, I have to think. If I travel, I have to think, I have to plan, I have to prepare. And I'm not doing this in an insane way. We're just being conscious and careful and cautious and not worrying what people think. I just have to do what I have to do. And the rest of the steps, I'm going to tell you, you know, from 2 to 12, it's a spiritual journey. And when I came to OA, most of us, I mean, I came because I felt like crap and because I wanted to die and because I was an overeater and I didn't know what else to do. I did not come for a spiritual solution. I was not interested in spirituality. But I knew that there was something different about OA because it wasn't a diet program. And as I already knew, diets don't work. And food plans were not going to be a solution for me. And to this day, there's a million, everybody has a magic cure in the diet world. But in OA, we have a spiritual solution. And I know that's where I need to keep my attention. In the AA Big Book, it says that we have a daily reprieve that's based on our spiritual condition. Unquestionably, my attention has got to be from now until eternity to be on my spiritual condition, my spiritual growth through the 12 steps, and then through a deepening of my spiritual life that I have gotten as a result of having been involved in OA and learning that my relationship with a higher power, who I choose to call God, is the answer to the solution to my problem. One I would not have chosen, by the way, if I was choosing. It was one that was handed to me and I took at a. So step two is come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. And I didn't know God except for through my religious training and upbringing. And that didn't give me a spiritual life. It gave me some religious thing that really was more cultural than anything that I felt was personal. But to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity required that I start to learn about how to pray or learn about God, be open to this. And in doing that, I meant I had to ask questions and listen to people who were spiritual in the program. And I listened and I watched people in the program who are spiritual, who have relationship with God, who had what I wanted, and asked them, how do you pray? What do you read? How do you do it? And then trying on their spiritual practices and being willing to learn something I didn't want to learn because I understood that my way was not working. And this was the solution that I become spiritually minded and grow along spiritual lines. Step two. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Today, I say unquestionably, though I had no idea what I was doing when I started, today I will say that has become true. I can't say I'm totally sane, but I still will seek after God for my sanity. Step three is made a decision to turn our life and will over to the care of God as we understand him. I believe in step three, this is about desperate dependence. And I would say for myself, as someone who did not get abstinent easily, it took me 2.5 years. And then I explained to people, it took me 5 years till I was free. I still had a lot of food thoughts. I still felt crazy. I was not calm. Didn't settle down for quite a long time. I still thought about my meals all the time. I still felt a little nuts. Like if I didn't get my food by dinner time, I was like, you know, there was still just a lot of, you know, angst around food. I didn't have peace. And, you know, I think it wasn't until I realized this desperate dependence that the third step talks about, where you truly have a relationship with God. And that, and I believe today that it's like, I understand today that my spirituality is the food that I always needed. It's like that. It's like, you know, when we take our phones and charge them, because if you don't charge them, the battery dies or the computer doesn't work if you don't charge it. It's like me. I mean, as a person, I'm a spiritual person. If I don't plug in, I will not be charged. I will not work. And I think it's like food was a false charge. It's like trying to charge with the wrong energy. And trying to keep on filling up with the wrong energy and then wondering why it's not working. And then finding in the spiritual path the energy that I need and the strength that I need and the wisdom and the direction that I need to live and to know how to function. And so this is, I think, the third step is to surrender to that process and to learn that I am completely dependent on my relationship with God in order to be free and to live without needing food as my energy source in that way. And that's really something to come to, especially for somebody who doesn't want that. So steps 4 to 9 are the working steps, okay? And those are the steps that I know we all stall out on. They're the steps where you write your inventory in step 4, and then you give it away in 5. I would say for myself, I had no trouble with step 4. I had a lot of bad things to say about myself. I don't think that's exactly the point of step 4, is to just beat yourself with a club, but I had a 2x4 that I was using to beat myself over the head with. So I was happy to do that. Let me find all the ways that I can tell you that are horrible about me. And that's really where I started with my 4-step. But I think it's good to, like, also, I think the 4-step when I first started doing mine, and for anybody who's still new at this and or who have avoided the 4-step, because I think a lot of people don't recover because they don't go all the way through the steps and they sort of stall out here. This is really important to finish the steps, do the steps. I'm so glad people told me that. The steps work. You got to do the steps. Because it's this house cleaning process of getting out all the junk and the guck and all the reasons that we eat. They have to get cleaned out in order to not have fuel for overeating. I know when I look at all the gunk and all the junk, it's the guilt and the shame from all the mistakes and the, you know, from all the dumb things in life, or bad feelings, or the self-esteem and the anger and the anxiety and the fear, all that stuff that's in there that didn't get dealt with. Food was being used to numb that all out and shut that all down. So it has to come out and get cleaned out, and then be healed. And then we need to heal. So this process, it's so wise. I mean, the people who came up with these steps, it's so wise. It works, but it is painstaking and it's very hard to do. So, you know, I am so grateful to the people, because I am this very emotional, sensitive person. I've gotten better. I'm a little less so as I've gotten older and I've done a lot of healing work. I would say as I've done, you know, my first 4-step was superficial. I don't think I knew myself too well. And I, you know, but it's like, you got to start somewhere, right? So you start by taking answering some questions in a booklet, you know, and then, you know, you take the first layer of stuff off, but then maybe go deeper and then a little deeper. House cleaning goes deeper until you really learn to be more real and more authentic, and then learn to kind of just be honest with yourself. And so I'm grateful, and I'm grateful for the people, so grateful for the people who put up with me while I was going through these stages of my recovery, because I was an emotional wreck. I was a teenager, a college student. I was highly, intensely emotional. It's no wonder I needed to eat half gallons of ice cream and boxes of cookies to shut all that down, because I had a lot of feelings that needed to be shut down and numbed out. So in order to be able to get that up, people had to sit with me and learn and hold my hand and teach me to feel my feelings and be sane and normal and be able to grow and learn how to handle my feelings in a sane way instead of making them stop. Food was a great escape. And recovery teaches how to grow up and how to face feelings in a sane and healthy adult way. So I'm just so grateful because people really did. They were so patient. And so I try to give that to others, to be patient when people are stumbling around in these hard areas. I'm talking about the fourth step. And then the fifth step is where we give it away. And that's where these patient people, and we have, and you know, not to be afraid to ask people to sit with us, because we need to do that for each other, to be there for each other and to walk these things out. So I know I have a little bit of time left, but I want to try to get through the rest of the steps really quickly. In step 6 and 7, I really think it's important. Step 6 and 7 is where we become entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character, and we humbly ask him to remove them. It's really, really important to understand. I used to think like, oh, I'm such a mess. I'm such a mess. I'm afraid of everything. I had no courage, no guts. I felt like I couldn't do anything right. I felt stupid. You know, like I couldn't do school right. I couldn't, like here I am speaking now. If it wasn't for the help of this step, actually was the step that helped me to learn how to speak. Because I had to put my fear, sort of ask God to remove the fear and learn then to step into in by faith that I could speak. My sponsor taught me how to do that, how to turn it over and ask for help to have fear removed. But I still have to practice having my defects removed. I don't have the courage on my own. It's only by having God help me, having him take the defects away. Not that I become strong in myself. I become strong because God removes my defects. And it's really important not to look at myself for the strength, but to look, just like I need to look to God for help with my absence, I need him to help me with all of the troubles, the fears of intimacy, the fears of, work things that scare me that I think I can't do. The fears could be endless. I was trained up in fear, and that's the, like my family, generations of fear. And so, being courageous only can come from faith and from being able to turn these areas over with help from my friends in the program, my other friends that I now have that I trust, and from my higher power. And so 8 and 9, I mean, we could talk all day. I know, I think I really have to start to wrap up, right, Shari? Is it my time 10?
Coming up on, it's like 45 seconds to 30 minutes.
Okay, so I have 15 minutes about, so is that, yes, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so, well, let me just talk about steps 8 and 9, because this is a very, very important part of my story. And usually when I share this part, this is one of the parts that I think a lot of people tend to kind of pay attention to. And steps 8 and 9 is the amend steps, where we make a list of people we have harmed and become willing to make amends. And then we do make amends in step 9. One of the lines in the AA Big Book that was completely transformative for me In the AA Big Book, it says resentment is the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything else. Well, you'll notice that I have that memorized. That line in the Big Book changed my life. I am quite certain of it. That, and then also the story where it talks about praying for the people who you resent. And a few other things that really helped me. When I came into the program, and I mentioned a little bit about my mom, but I hated my mom. I feel bad saying that today. I love her. We say we love each other. We kiss each other today. We talk. But you know what? When I was a teenager, I hated her. I hated her. I didn't want to be in the same room with her. I know now today she hated me because of my weight. And she demonstrated that in, you know, her mean looks. She was very hostile. She was not a loving and nurturing mom. And so I grew up with just criticism and put downs and no nurturing. And so she really hurt me. She wrecked my self-esteem. And, you know, I forgive her. I forgive her today. I understand today after years of therapy and this program, I understand that she was raised by people who treated her like that. So she doesn't know any better. I understand that. And today, because of this program, I was led to forgive her and then also then to love her. And my sponsor in a meeting heard, I was like a bratty teenager. And I said in a meeting, well, I'll accept my mom as a human being, but that's as far as I'm going. And my sponsor says to me, she's in the room. We were in New Jersey at that time. And in a meeting where we used to share over candlelight, it was a great place. I said that, and my sponsor came up to me and she said, you know, you're never going to stop eating if you hate your mom. She said, you're never going to stop eating. You're never going to get abstinent and you have to love your mom. You're going to have to love her. Well, that was hard. And I really didn't want to love my mom. I didn't think she deserved my love, but I came to understand that I deserved to not hate my mom because my hate to my mom was hurting me, not because she deserved my love, because I deserved to not hate. And I learned that resentment was hurting me. I had another sponsor later who used to say that resentment was like chocolate candy and that it was like a first bite to resent somebody like that. And so it's something to really think about. And so that story, I'm only giving you a little bit of it, but it was a life-changing experience. And it taught me, you know, as much as I can, and I can't say I am not perfect. It's hard to keep turning over, like when you're wounded or hurt by people who really do truly hurt us, to be able to somehow find a way to turn those hurts over and forgive people who are hurtful. And I've had several experiences that are horrible in my life. People who have hurt me so bad, who I have had to forgive because I know it's God's will to forgive. And because I know I can't live with resentment and bitterness because it hurts me more than it hurts them. But that doesn't come automatically. I have to work that out. Sometimes I have to do a lot of hard work and prayer and talking and, you know, kind of pushing, you know, writing out my feelings, talking through them, coming to the place of getting it sorted. It doesn't always come. Like, I can't always automatically forgive. I'm human. If somebody really hurts me, I have to work it out. But food is not the way. And leaving it there is not the way. I have to keep my house clean if I want to have an abstinent life. So I know I only have a few minutes. 10, 11, and 12 are the maintenance steps. And I learned a long time ago, and again, I want to say this in terms of anchors. Everything I do today in my life, I do, it's all protection against relapse. And mostly I learned through the School of Hard Knocks and falling down during the early days when I was relapsing. Almost everything I learned you have to do these steps and keep doing them and keep practicing and don't stop practicing. Even when I was falling, I was learning. I fell down and hard. I realized, oh, I don't do a 10th step. Well, start doing your 10th step because the 10th step is the daily inventory. And if I don't keep my house clean, things are going to build up. If I let my emotions build, if I let fears build up, if I let anxiety build up, if I let discord build up, if I let myself become, I have problems with procrastination and letting administrative responsibilities. This is an area of difficulty for me. I have to keep on accountability around these things that I have difficulty with, my weaknesses, things that I have struggles with. And I'm not reached perfection in any way. I constantly need to ask for help for the things that I struggle with. Because I learned a long time ago, we don't arrive. There's no destination that you arrive and now we're all over and it's all fixed now. It's a lifetime of practicing these things and turning over and asking for help and keep on trying to do better. Prayer and meditation, for me, I do not have it perfect, but I know that soaking and spending time with God and finding deep places where I connect spiritually is, for me, like I said earlier, the food that I always needed. It is the place that I need to go. I need to be quiet. I need to be still. I need to listen, not just spill out a bunch of prayers and say, okay, rub, thank you, here's my gratitude list, read the four today, and now I'm gone. That's not prayer meditation. I have to listen. I have to reflect on what I'm reading and let it into my soul and my spirit and let it work into me so that it means something to me. And I'm actually living and breathing in what I'm reading. And for me, I've had to go way past. I love the big book. I love the readings of the 12 step. I never stop getting something out of it. I like to take it slow and just take in little bits at a time and read and take it in and let it count for something. So it's meaningful and it's life-giving. It can't just be something I do to check off my list. So I did it. Meditation is a relational experience of receiving a message. So it's meaningful to me. And it works into knit into my who I am. Now, am I perfect at it? No. It has to happen for me. I need to keep growing in this way. I need to keep pursuing my spiritual growth. And sometimes I need to take off time and spend extra time because I'm getting dry or I'm not having enough. Sometimes a retreat, a time at the beach, a day off where I'm just still to rest and quiet. Maybe even once a weekend I try to take off where I'm not running around and just spend time in reflection and on prayer, taking prayer walks, resting, breathing. It's important every day to have balance and live a spiritual life. And then step 12 is, sharing the message. I think it's very, very important to be patient with other people, to no matter where we are. For me, I can tell you, I remember like yesterday, I had a sponsor. This was when I was still just getting abstinent finally, which I didn't know it was going to be finally because I fell so many times. Who knew when it would start sticking? But this particular time, I was abstinent for a little while, and this person who I loved and I looked up to, her son came into OA, and she said, he was like a little bit close to my age, and she said, would you sponsor my son? So I didn't think I had anything to give, because I felt so bad about myself for all my messy mess. But she asked me to please, you're young, I think you would help him. And I tried to help him. And I just did it because she I couldn't say no to her. So, but it helped me to help somebody else. And I would say that in those early years, when I was just a young person who felt really crappy, there were several people who asked me to help out in different ways, help this new person or do this service. Like Mary Frances said, I was doing stuff that I had no courage or confidence to do. but someone said, could you help here? Could you do this? And I just did it because somebody like thought I should or should try it, you know? And I think sharing or helping in some way, it helps to build your recovery. Like, I feel like all those little things that you say yes to helps to reinforce and strengthen recovery. And it also helps to make, like, I feel like it's harder to go backwards when you're in the process of helping another person. When I think about picking up, I think of all the people who would be hurt if they saw that I lost my recovery, because people look up to me today and it helps me. I don't want to be a part of other people having to see the program as a failure. I want people to feel like it's a hope, there's hope here. I'm not saying I feel like the weight of OA is on my shoulders, but I know how bad it feels to see people fall. So it helps me just a little to think that I have a responsibility to, you know, to be a part of the salute to the hope that we share with each other. So I know my time is up. And, you know, I just want to leave by just saying thank you for letting me talk and just saying this. Don't quit wherever you are. When I look at myself, I think it's a messy process. I think it's a difficult process. Sometimes you have more or less time. Sometimes it's hard to figure out. But if I look at my life and I say, why am I in recovery? Like, I am nobody special. I'm just some kid from Philadelphia who listened to what they said and followed the steps that they laid out. Those alcoholics, I thank God for them. I just did what they said. I'm just another person. And I've been blessed with abstinence and life. I'm not saying I have a perfect life. I have had a lot of troubles, but at least I'm not in that hellhole of food addiction. And I would never, ever want to live that life again. I would never trade. I will take every trouble I have in my life compared to that trouble. So it's worth fighting for, even though, you know, recovery can be hard. I wouldn't trade it for nothing. It's worth fighting for abstinence, and it does get better if you just don't give up. So thank you.